here we go. This morning we're beginning in earnest a new series on the seven core practices of Nexus, or practices we would like to collectively define who we are becoming together as a community. And these are the practices that we sort of want to make common as we travel the Christian path together in community. And so you can see them up on the screen. These are the seven practices. And over the next few weeks, we're going to look at them one by one. We're going to devote a week to each of them, exploring each of them in detail. And we're going to do things a little bit differently. I'm bringing along a historical mystery along for the journey. So we're going to talk about a historical mystery. And my hope is that it will be very intriguing to you, but also help sort of frame why these practices, why we think they're important. And there's going to be other voices and stories. Some friends are coming up here this morning after I'm done to share a little bit about spiritual growth. So this is where we're sort of heading over the next 7 weeks. It's going to look a little bit different, more interactive than normal. You've got cards in your hands. There's a table to explore shortly. But let's dive in this morning and talk about our first practice. You can see it up on the screen here. Is this the path, the Christian path that we travel on is one of spiritual growth and character development. So this is what we've sort of written here at Nexus. The Christian path we travel is designed to help us grow and develop into fully flourishing human beings who love God and others. As such, at Nexus, we're interested in nurturing the spiritual growth and character development of everyone who chooses to journey with us, and we're committed to using whatever tools or practices will help us achieve this end. Now, I wrote that, so I believe it. But here's the thing. If I'm being honest with you, if this wasn't explained well, something like this could very easily be seen as trite and cliche. I don't think this necessarily lends itself to being very inspiring. Perhaps worse, it might even seem to some of you to be dull and boring. So what I want to admit up front from the start is this: spiritual growth is not sexy at all. And I think for a lot of people today, spiritual growth feels tired, right? Like, how many times have we heard this at churches that were about spiritual growth? And so I would say this: I think for many of us, the work of spiritual growth, it feels way too pious and disconnected from what really matters in the world, right? I mean, who has time for prayer when we're not even sure what it does? Who has time to attend to our inner lives when the world needs generosity? Why work on character when there's justice to work for? Why work on our hearts when we could work on some creative project? I mean, working on our inner lives seems like a luxury when so many of us are already very tired, we're very busy, we don't have a lot of time to spare. But maybe there are fresher ways to think about this. There must be a better way. So here's my hope. I'm going to try to give you two alternative frames for looking at spiritual growth this morning. One is positive, one is negative. And then we're going to have some friends come up and talk a little bit about their experience with spiritual growth. So what I want to do is start with the great mystery of the Anasazi people. And it's a mystery that I become borderline obsessed with. So travel with me to the U.S. Southwest, if you will. Back around 1100, 1200 AD, you can see this is what the area looks like on Google Maps. But before the Ute or the Navajo or the Hopi were in the area, these tribes were in the area. And the Anasazi, right around the Four Corners there, is a group of people, an ancient group of people. I become obsessed with figuring out. The remnants of these people, the Anasazi, they were discovered in the 1880s. Richard Weatherhill, his brothers, they began exploring the remote canyons of the U.S. Southwest. And the U.S. Southwest is one of the harshest, least forgiving environments on the planet. And as far as these brothers knew, they were the first people to set foot in some of these remote canyons, these back canyons. But they stumbled upon something absolutely remarkable. Ancient runes set high up in canyon cliffs. And not just one or two of these runes, hundreds of them, tucked away in these isolated, inaccessible canyons. Now, perhaps The most famous of these is Messe Verde. This is what it looked like when Weatherhill discovered it, late 1800s. This is what it looks like today. Next slide. Now that it's all cleaned up and you can go and you can visit there. Hundreds of ruins. This is the grandest of them, but hundreds of these in these isolated canyons. And what was so tantalizing about these ruins is that they revealed an incredibly sophisticated culture of people. At these sites, you would find shards of gorgeous pottery littering these sites. Many of the buildings showed complex astrological alignments. And the network of trade of these people is just mind-blowing. At these sites, the earliest discoverers, they found seashells, which is remarkable because the Pacific Ocean is over 1,000 kilometers away. They also found hundreds of skeletons of macaw birds in cages that they had just been left there, it seems, which is also remarkable because the native habitat of macaw birds is over 2,000 kilometers away. Their trade routes were massive. And more so, what littered these sites are art, so much art chiseled into the canyon walls, art of animals, odd figures, hands, spirals, lots and lots of spirals. And even more perplexing was that what every site seems to have in common is that they were abandoned with haste, almost overnight, it seemed. It was though these people, whoever they were, simply left for the afternoon one day and never came back. Most Anasazi sites so show signs of being vacated almost precisely to the year 1280. And so they seem to have built these magnificent, mysterious cliff dwellings all over the U.S. Southwest and then just seem to vanish. How does a sophisticated culture just vanish without a trace? And so since then, the great archaeological question has been, what happened to the Anasazi? Where did they go? And so over the next few weeks, I want to talk about the layers of this mystery because it's beyond fascinating. And over the next few weeks, we're going to explore this riddle in conjunction with the series, and it will take us to some beautiful places, also some really disturbing places, because the archaeological evidence is just wild to me. I hope it's of interest to you as well. But the first clue about where they went comes from their art, and it speaks to the nature of spiritual growth. The Anasazi were known for leaving this spiral shape on thousands of canyon walls. Why? What does it mean? My friend Riley and I, we've seen dozens of these spirals on rocks, and we would ask rangers, park rangers, anyone we could get to, what did this mean? They seemed to leave it everywhere. What did this spiral mean? Nobody had a great answer, and so I've been reading all these archaeological books, which is kind of weird, but two in particular, Craig Childs, David Roberts, they have this captivating theory about the meaning of the spiral. U.S. Southwest is notoriously dry. It's one of the hardest regions in the world to find a reliable source of water. And so these people made these grand settlements, but the theory is this. The Anasazi were migratory people constantly in search of water. And so the spiral is a symbol of constant migration, constantly looking for water. Water meant life. No water, no crops, no food, game would move on. Water and life were intricately connected. And so they built these beautiful structures, but they never got attached to staying in one place. When the water dried up, when the rains moved on, they simply packed up and left. And so water for them was connected to life and constant motion, constantly moving, never getting too comfortable because life for them was dictated by water. Where the water goes, you follow. Now, there's so much more to this story, but this is the first piece, and it speaks to me of spiritual growth. In the Anasazi world, where there's water, you follow. Where there is life from water, you follow. And it's become a powerful sort of metaphor or narrative to me about the spiritual world, spiritual growth. In the spiritual realm, I believe, it's one of constant movement as well. And it's no accident Jesus refers to himself in John chapter 4 as the water of life. And Jesus is sort of claiming it's in following him, in that movement of following him, that we find and understand our true selves. By following him, we're following the water, following where life is, always moving. There's this great story in Scripture. John chapter 6 has become one of my favorite chapters in all of Scripture. Jesus is delivering difficult teaching, really tough teaching, and people are grumbling. And so this exchange happens. Many of his disciples said, "This is a hard teaching. Who can accept it?" And aware that his disciples were grumbling about this, Jesus said to them, "Does this offend you? The Spirit gives life. The words I have spoken to you, they are full of the Spirit and life. Yet there are some of you who do not believe." From this time, many of his disciples turned back and no longer followed him. Then he said to the 12, "You do not want to leave too, do you?" And Simon Peter answered him, "Lord, to whom shall we go? You have the words of eternal life. Jesus, you are the water. You're where the life is." And so when we talk about spiritual growth and character development here at Nexus, it's always about that. Finding life. The never-ending quest, the constant migration, movement towards becoming our better selves, our truer selves. We're all in search of water, of life, what it means to be fully and authentically human. And so spiritual growth is all about that. And so our ask here is this at Nexus, and why we want to make and take this practice very seriously. Would you commit to constant movement? Would you commit to your own growth and development? Would you make that a priority to following the life, the water, following Christ to your truer, better self? Now, frame two, because here's the thing. There are some of you, like me, when I hear this metaphor stuff of migration, I'm like, "Ooh, that totally works for me. Just works for me." But my guess is this, for some of you, you're like, "What are you talking about? Like following water and migration and our better, truer selves?" For some people, I think that's sort of too mystical, maybe not gritty enough. So here's what I want to do. I want to give you another frame to think about spiritual growth through. It's a more negative angle to consider spiritual growth from, but I think for some of us, it will be quite helpful. I had a meeting about a year ago with the CEO of NetSuite here in downtown Kitchener, Joseph Fung, a fascinating guy. They're doing phenomenal things downtown. They've got a real great social consciousness about downtown. I was meeting with him. He was talking to me about the corporate culture, and he handed me a book and said, "You need to read this. This book sort of shapes the way we do things at NetSuite. It's this book right here." And so I'm not a big business book guy, but I've been sort of flipping through this occasionally. And it's fascinating to me because it's very simple, and it defines for a lot of companies today their sort of corporate ethos. And the author, Sutton, he's a business professor at Stanford Business School. And in the book, he makes this case that people, companies who refuse to hire those kinds of people have better corporate cultures, and they make more money. And then he goes further and he applies it even more broadly. When there are fewer of those people, and when we try our best not to be these kinds of people ourselves, not only do businesses thrive, communities thrive, neighborhoods thrive, churches thrive, culture thrives. It's an interesting book. How does this connect with spiritual growth, our first practice in development? Well, what I would say is this. Sometimes spiritual growth doesn't come across as very sexy or important. I think it's because it feels overly pious. But I would say this. Boiled down, the reason you should take spiritual growth seriously is this. Spiritual growth is about becoming less of an asshole. And I know that's blunt. And I try to use strong language here sparingly, but it really does sum up the task of spiritual growth. If that's a bit too on the nose for you, let me say it this way. Spiritual growth is about sanding off the worst edges of ourselves. And you know, here's the thing. When people say to me, "Well, I'm not sure I'm into prayer. I'm not sure I'm into meditation. I'm not sure spiritual disciplines are my thing." I totally get it. I do. I'm not sure they're my thing either. I don't really like doing them, but they exist as tools to help me sand off the worst parts of myself. This past week, I was in New York, and we were flying home from New York to Buffalo, and I just hate travel. Like, the flight was 55 minutes from New York to Buffalo, and it took like 8 hours, just the whole day, right? Just, oh. So I got lost going out to LaGuardia. We get to the airport. We get on the plane. You know, there's always one of those people, right, who they can't get their bag in the overhead compartment, and you're just, what in the world? And so there's this guy. He's like, I don't know. I can't get it in. I'm like, you got to push. You got to go. Just get it in there. So annoyed. And then we got in queue, and the pilot's like, well, we're going to be sitting here for about 30 minutes because there were 16 planes ahead of us to take off. Like, oh, it's getting so annoyed. And then we're ready to take off, and I'm like, oh, I don't have gum. So I said to my brother, hey, can I have a piece of gum? He's like, no, sorry, I can't give you some of my gum. What? It's like I only have 5 pieces left. He wouldn't give me a piece of gum. Like, ah. So annoyed, my ears are going to be popped. So I'm already not in a great headspace. And then it happens. We take off. In 30 seconds, I hear it behind me. Someone is being sick behind me. I won't say much more than that, but being sick. And I'm like, oh, Lord, give me strength. Are you kidding me? And it wasn't just once. It was every time the plane did this, that noise, and I'm just like, I'm going to lose my mind. And then the stewardess came by or whatever, and they're trying, I'm like, oh, here, let me take that bag. We'll get you more bags. I'm like, are you kidding me? I'm trying to give them pills or something. I was just like, don't turn around. Just focus. And it kept going on the whole flight. This person being sick. And you know, at a certain point, you don't want to do anything really mean, but you want to let people know you're not happy, so you start doing the sigh thing. Just, so I start sighing a lot. Just, I'm seething inside. And then we land, and I'm like, I have got to get out of here because of the smell, right? You know, you got that thing, breathe it, just the smell. And so the ding goes off. You can take off your seatbelts. Get out of here. I grab my bag and I go. I'm like, I got to take a look at who this person was that ruined my flight. Turn around. I got my backpack and there it's a 70-year-old woman. And she's crying. And her granddaughter's rubbing her back. And I am like, I am a horrible being. I am the worst. Oh. I mean, I was that guy on the plane. You know, that guy? The impatient guy who has no empathy for anyone else because you think the whole world is about your own comfort. That guy. I was the guy on the plane that nobody likes in real life. You encounter these people and you're like, nobody likes those people. And here's the thing, in that moment, I was like, oh my goodness, I was so angry at a 70-year-old woman, I can't believe that. I was sighing out loud. And I realized in that moment, it wasn't that, it doesn't matter if the person's 70 or 20 or whatever, why would you get angry? Somebody's sick. Their experience is a whole lot worse than my own, and yet I was so angry about it. And what I realized in the moment is this, if I had simply been just a little bit more mindful, had I in that moment just remembered just to pray, if I had just said, Brad, just pray or meditate, if I had had any one of a number of spiritual practices at hand, I could have sanded down that nasty edge of myself on the plane. And let's be honest, here's the truth. We can all be that person who adds nothing positive to the world or any experience. It can be at home. Can be at work, online, with friends, at school, in public, and on airplanes. We can be horrible people. And it doesn't mean you even have to say a thing. It's just the energy that you're giving off sometimes. Personal, spiritual growth is the very real hard work of not being that person. And so it's not about private piety or praying for hours on end. It's simply the real work of becoming more of the kind of person who actually blesses the world and less of the kind of person who makes the world hellish. But it doesn't happen easily. It takes work, real work. It's about movement, migrating towards our better selves. Consider the fruit of the Spirit. The work of spiritual growth is about developing these kinds of traits that are mentioned in Galatians 5. And here's one of the things that I've noticed recently about the fruit of the Spirit. They're all social virtues. They're all social characteristics. They're all about how we interact with other people. Consider this. It's pretty hard to be gentle or kind or peaceful or patient or faithful or loving when you're by yourself. They're about how we relate to other people. Even self-control. That's a critical component of learning how to be patient or loving or kind. You learn to master your temper, hold your tongue. It's a social quality. Even joy, which seems like a personal disposition, it has a huge effect on our social worlds. I mean, think about it. What's more pleasant to be around, someone who has joy or someone who's bitter and cynical? But here's the thing, developing these characteristics, it doesn't happen magically. It takes work. We need practice and tools to help us in the long work of following Christ to become our better selves. Or consider the love chapter, 1 Corinthians 13. Love is what? It's patient, it's kind, it's not jealous or boastful or proud or rude. It does not demand its own way. It's not irritable. It keeps no record of wrongs. Same thing, they're social qualities. It's not a private or pious thing. And so spiritual growth is about becoming a better human being. And I don't know of a practice that might be more important than that. And so spiritual growth is not sexy, but it's incredibly important. We practice spiritual growth in order to become more loving, in order to develop the fruit of the Spirit, to be a fully flourishing human being. Spiritual growth is about growing and developing, being the kind of human beings who love God and others, or, if you prefer it this way, it's about being less of an asshole. And that might sound harsh, but here's the thing. That I can get behind. And if I told Kristen that was my goal in life, I'm positive she would get behind that too. And my neighbors, and you. That's something I can get excited about. And so two frames for you. It's about migrating towards our better selves and true life, and also being less of the kind of people who make our homes, our churches, our places of work, our cities, even airplanes, more miserable. And so this practice is important to us for those two reasons, but I'm going to now have a seat, and I've asked some friends to come and share with us. And so Murray, who is so our champion of spiritual growth here, he's going to come and share some reflections on spiritual growth, and then Katie and Ruthie are going to come as well.